Good afternoon. It's good to see everyone. Welcome to the first meeting of the Finance and Facilities Subcommittee. So we'll call the meeting to order. Members, please make sure to turn on your microphone when answering roll call. These new microphones are very good, and they can pick up even the softest of talkers and won't be affected by our masks. So and make sure you keep your mask on even when speaking into the microphone. With that, Cheryl, please call the roll.
Chair Yarbrough?
Here.
Representatives Beltran?
Here.
Benjamin? Botana?
Here.
Bussada Cabrera?
Here.
Caruso?
Here.
Chaney?
Here.
Duran?
Here.
Fabricio? Fabricio?
Here.
Panchowski?
Here.
Joseph?
Here.
Mello?
Here.
Mooney?
Here.
Mooney?
Can't hear.
Morales?
Present.
Persons Malika?
Present.
Sabatini?
Here.
Tant?
Present.
Williamson? Williamson?
Here.
Form is present.
Thank you, Cheryl. Again, members, welcome to the Finance and Facilities Subcommittee. Just briefly, I wanted to mention that this subcommittee's jurisdiction includes issues related to access and affordability of healthcare, and the issues include price transparency, regulation of healthcare facilities, and the operation of the state's Medicaid program for low-income Floridians. The subcommittee also addresses health insurance and the state employee group health plan. And we cover several state agencies. That includes ACA, which is the Agency for Healthcare Administration, the Department of Veterans Affairs for their nursing home issues, and also the Office of Insurance Regulation related to health insurance coverage issues. And also, members, briefing materials that describe the jurisdiction of our subcommittee have been distributed to your office and placed before you on the desk. And also, you received an email from me before the January 11th interim committee week, and I hope you've had an opportunity or do have one soon to review the information, and that will help us and help you as we discharge our duties of our committee. So since our interim committee week schedules have been limited this year, we're not receiving as many introductory presentations that we have in years past. And so because of this, I also sent you some emails to some presentations that were made before this committee. And in recent years, it could have been named something different. This one was health market reform. So if you go to look anything up, you might see a different title, but in essence, it's the same the purview and jurisdiction. But if you would take the time to review the materials and the links that we sent you, and certainly reach out to me or staff if you have any questions. Okay. So at this time, I just want to give each of the members a brief opportunity to introduce yourselves, and we only have 1 hour for the committee, so let's make it very brief. And I'll start at the end with Rep. Sabatini. Just mention your name and also the area you represent, then we'll move to the next member.
Thank you. Anthony Sabatini, Lake County, Florida.
Rep. Nick Duran, House District 112, parts of Miami, Coral Gables, and Village of Key Biscayne.
Mike Caruso, District 89, Palm Beach County.
And Rep. Caruso also serving as our capable vice chair. Thank you. And I'm Clay Yarbrough, District 12, which is all within Jacksonville. Ranking member.
Good afternoon. Representative Dottie Joseph, proudly representing Florida House District 108, which is entirely in Miami-Dade County. And we are excited about whatever we can to make sure that Floridians have more access to affordable health care.
Allison Tant, House District 9, you are in my district. It's always great to have everybody in Tallahassee. I am very focused on quality of health care and access to health care. I have a son who is the poster child for the need for health care since he was an infant. So I'm very focused on that. So thank you.
Christopher Benjamin, representing House District 107, that's in Miami-Dade County, as far north as you can get without crossing the county line. My focus here would be on access to health care, and I look forward to working with all of you. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Mike Beltran, District 57, Southeast Hillsboro. Good to be here.
Good afternoon. Adam Botana, District 76, Benito Estero in coastal Lee County. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Lauren Mello. I'm District 80, that is Eastern Collier County, which is Naples. I cover LaBelle and Clewiston, Hendry County. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jenna Persons Mullica, House District 78, Fort Myers, Florida.
Hello, I'm Linda Cheney, House District 69, which is Pinellas County, South Beaches, and I look forward to bringing my experience running a mobile mammography business to this committee.
Hi, I'm Christine Hunchofsky from District 96, which is Northern Broward County.
Hello, everyone, and greetings, Chairman and committee members. My name is Representative Daisy Morales, and I represent House District 48, which is located in Orange County, and I serve where the Central Florida International Airport is located. Thank you.
J.R. Williamson, House District 3. My border to the south is the Gulf of Mexico. My border to the north is the state of Alabama, and I'm right outside of the city of Pensacola.
Demi Busada Cabrera, District 114, Miami-Dade County, parts of Coral Gables, West Miami, Pinecrest, South Miami, and Cutler Bay.
Tom Fabricio, House District 103, representing Southwest Broward and Northwest Miami-Dade County.
Jim Mooney, House District 120, representing from Key West up into the mainland, part of Homestead, and to the west of the Collier County line.
Great, thank you very much. And between Rep. Williamson and Rep. Mooney, we got the whole state covered. We got from Pensacola all the way down to the Keys, so we're good, good. Thank you very much, members. And just briefly, I wanted to mention, too, a couple of more individuals, a few more individuals I wanted to introduce to you, which is our very capable staff. Our new policy chief is Eric Lloyd. Eric is right here to my right, and he is a long-serving staff member that comes to us from the Commerce Committee. Cheryl DeWeese is our very capable administrative assistant, and she is highly experienced, and we share her with full HHS. So we're glad to have you too, Cheryl. And is Krista, did Krista make it? Okay, Krista's downstairs. Krista is our staff director for HHS, who also helps oversee our work, and she's not in the meeting, but we wanted to mention her as well. Okay, so thank you, members, again. And at this time, we'll move forward on the agenda, and we will have a brief introduction by the acting secretary for the Agency for Healthcare Administration, or ACA, and that is Siobhan Harris. Secretary Harris, can you hear us?
I can hear you okay. Can you hear me?
We can.
Okay, great. So Chairman Yarborough, Vice Chair Caruso, and members of the committee, thank you for having me this afternoon. I look forward to working with you all this legislative session. I've been with the agency for 15 years, the majority of that time serving on the Medicaid leadership team. So it is an honor to serve the state in this capacity as acting secretary. My agency plays a pivotal role in licensing and regulating over 40,000 healthcare facilities and administering the Medicaid program for over 4.5 million low-income individuals. I appreciate the opportunity to provide a brief overview of what our team is focusing on, and we'll be happy to answer any questions afterwards. So I'll start by discussing our efforts related to COVID-19, mitigating the spread of the virus in our long-term care facilities and protecting Florida's most vulnerable. We shifted our resources from routine work to prioritize complaint inspections and visits to facilities with previous infection control issues at the onset of the pandemic. So beginning in March through December, field offices completed more than 7,000 focused infection control surveys in nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and intermediate care facilities. Throughout these surveys, not only did our team examine for potential infection control issues, but we also educated our partners on how to best mitigate the spread of COVID-19 among their residents and staff. Throughout the public health emergency, our team has been incredibly focused on ensuring that Florida's Medicaid recipients were able to receive the healthcare services that they needed without disruption. Florida was the first state to submit an 1135 waiver authority to extend flexibilities and provide enrollment and to waive prior authorization requirements under the Medicaid program. In addition, we implemented other flexibilities to ensure critical coverage and access to healthcare services, such as waiving copayments, lifting service limits, ensuring access to early refills of prescriptions, and significantly expanding access through telehealth. As the COVID numbers increased in long-term care facilities and hospitals, we supported enforcement of the emergency orders that were issued through the Division of Emergency Management, including mandatory screenings of both staff and visitors at long-term care facilities, and then visitation restrictions when they were temporarily put in place. We established 23 COVID isolation facilities throughout the state to support long-term care providers and to help with hospital decompression efforts. Currently, we're focused on providing support to the Department of Health and Division of Emergency Management in supporting hospitals and long-term care facilities in their vaccination efforts. With over 7,000 COVID hospitalization and 3,000 positive cases among long-term care residents, we continue to focus on meeting with various provider associations and individual providers to ensure that we are responsive to their needs for relief whenever possible. Of course, due to the public health emergency that also had significant economic impacts on our state, Medicaid enrollment saw a 20% increase with an additional 700,000 individuals enrolling in Medicaid. We know of these new enrollees that a third are brand new and have never had prior enrollment in the program. With the continued extension of the public health emergency at the federal level, we will continue to benefit from the extension of the 6.2 percentage point FMAP in increase. And by extending the PHE, we also are required to maintain Medicaid eligibility for all Medicaid recipients until the public health emergency ends, thereby continuing benefits and ensuring that there's no gap in care. In terms of mitigating the impacts of the pandemic, one of the areas that we started to look at is what I'll call foregone health care, meaning people with chronic conditions who are not getting their screenings timely, or children who are not staying on top, or parents of children who are not staying on top of vaccinations due to fear or for other reasons. So we've launched a couple of outreach campaigns to try to improve outcomes in these two areas and are working closely with our health plans, the Department of Health, and other key partners to make sure we're doing everything that we can to get those individuals back into care. We also recognize the toll that this pandemic has taken on individuals' mental health and emotional well-being. We are launching a few initiatives related to behavioral health that are focused on addressing these concerns, as well as getting back to our quality improvement goals related to reducing potentially preventable hospital events and improving birth outcomes. Throughout all of this, we were able to successfully launch a couple of initiatives that I want to touch on. So we were able to launch earlier in 2020, a pilot program that's operating in key areas of the state, Pinellas, Pasco, Seminole, Orange, Osceola, and Brevard counties, that focuses on providing housing support or housing assistance to over 4,000 Medicaid recipients through our health plans. The goal of the pilot is to facilitate housing stability and improve health outcomes for those with mental illness or substance abuse disorders who are contending with homelessness or at risk of homelessness. Additionally, Governor DeSantis has been a national leader in the movement to safely import prescription drugs. Under his leadership, we've worked with the federal government to help shape federal policy on the importation of prescription drugs from Canada. We are in the process of implementing the program, which will yield an anticipated cost savings of $150 million annually to the state through taxpayer-funded programs, such as programs through the Department of Health, Department of Corrections, and the Agency for Persons with Disabilities. We look forward to helping the governor's vision to make prescription drug prices affordable for citizens of our state a reality. Thank you for the opportunity to introduce myself and share the incredible work that the staff here at the agency have been undertaking. Again, I look forward to working with you all throughout legislative session. I'm happy to take any questions.
Ms. Harris, we appreciate it, and especially given the amount of work that you're doing right now and all that's going on, we thank you for making time to introduce yourself and also to share what's going on and to take some questions for just a few minutes as your time allows. So thank you very much. We appreciate that. Members, we do have just a few minutes in this portion. If anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to recognize you. And Ranking Member Joseph, go ahead. You have one.
Good afternoon.
Just wanted to know what you're doing to address healthcare disparities. As you're aware, some communities are disproportionately impacted not just by COVID, but many of the issues that you identified. And I guess I also want to know specifically what you're doing in terms of outreach, because you mentioned some outreach efforts as well.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that question. So in terms of addressing disparities, we've been working with our health plans to make sure in the delivery of healthcare, they are looking at social determinants of health. So getting into communities that are contending with other challenges like housing insecurity, economic insecurity, food insecurity, other kinds of issues that impact their ability to access healthcare and healthcare in a timely manner. And so I know our health plans have a number of initiatives. I'd be happy to provide you with more information on that at a later date. Also, your second question was on, would you mind repeating the second part?
Sure, the
Ranking
second
member.
Part, thank
Go
you,
ahead.
Mr. Chair. The second part was, you mentioned outreach efforts that you have going on to address everything from vaccine hesitancy in some cases to other issues with parents and children. I'm asking, within those outreach efforts, what are your efforts specifically addressing healthcare disparities? And if you don't have that answer right now, you can contact my office to schedule a time so we can go over that stuff. Thank you.
You're recognized, Secretary.
Thank you. I appreciate that, and I apologize for drawing a blank. So related to outreach, we've, again, been working with our health plans on that. We have required them to use social media, texting, email, getting out to community stakeholders, sharing information to get the word out to parents and to reach them where they are accessing care or where they are going out into the community on a day-to-day basis. So using a number of different platforms to get the word out and to get them back into treatment and care. And yes, I can collect more information, and I'm happy to meet with you at a later date to give you more information on that.
Okay, thank you. Any additional questions, members? Anyone? Representative Morales, you're recognized.
Yes, thank you, Sherman. Just a quick question, Ms. Harris, you mentioned that your field goes out and inspects 7,000, am I correct, does 7,000 inspections? And is there any way that we can meet, or can I reach you where I can give you more questions that I have about it at a later time, if possible? Thank you.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, absolutely. So those inspections were done during the COVID period. So happy to meet with you and talk with you more about the inspections that we conducted or to answer any other questions that you may have.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Additional questions, members? Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Harris. We appreciate, again, your time and for the introduction and the information today. Thank you very much. We look forward to working with you.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Have a good afternoon. Members, moving next into the next portion of our agenda, we will hear today a briefing by Molly McKinstry. She is the Deputy Secretary of the Division of Health Quality Assurance within AHCA, and she will be talking about the implementation of the following bills. House Bill 1175, this is from 2016, related to transparency in healthcare. This was a bill run by Speaker Sprouse at that time. House Bill 319 was run in 2019, Patient Safety and Quality Measures, and this was a bill by Leader Grant. House Bill 763 last year in 2020, Patient Safety Culture Surveys. Leader Grant also did this bill. And then House Bill 21 back in 2019, which related to the Certificate of Need or CON repeal and licensure rulemaking. So members, also, you'll be interested to know that Ms. McKinstry has been very active in our state's COVID response. She has been working full-time in the State Emergency Operations Center and has taken time away from that important work to be with us today. Ms. McKinstry, can you hear us out there?
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Hello, we can. There we go. Now we can see you too.
Excellent.
Okay.
All right,
well, good afternoon, and you are recognized.
Thank you, and thank you all members for having us today. I actually have a presentation for you, so I'm going to try to share my screen here and see if we can make this work. And Cheryl is much more than an administrative assistant. I will tell you, she is a solid IT partner for your presenters in this meeting.
We're getting it pulled up, so we can see it. It's getting into presentation mode here shortly.
Great. There we go. So hopefully you're able to see the presentation now.
We can, yes.
Great, thank you. Well, thank you very much for having us today, and we appreciate the opportunity to review the legislation that has been passed by House leadership. That's obviously of great interest to your committee. Please know it's of great interest to the agency as well. So we will be going over the prior transparency efforts and a little bit of background as well, things that were in place prior to some of the recent legislation that you mentioned. We'll talk about the safety and quality transparency legislation, price transparency, and then just a status update on the repeal of the certificate of need for hospitals. This slide is just a snapshot of some of the material that's currently available on floridahealthfinder.gov. This is a nationally recognized website that has been in place for over two decades with the agency. It was originally authorized by the legislature under Chapter 400 and really has created a wonderful environment to share healthcare information with providers across the state and those looking for services from outside of Florida as well. So what we have for you here is a snapshot of some of the comparative tools that are presented in the Florida Health Finder website. And each of these is customized to the provider type. So we have an assisted living guide, home health agencies, hospice, nursing home, and hospital guides. Each of them has different information based upon data that is collected by the state and available to be packaged in a way that is helpful to consumers. Much of this information was tested with consumer groups to try to present information in a way that would be meaningful. So you'll see some of the tools have stars. Some of them actually pull in data from other resources, such as federal websites that rank home health agencies and provide information about their qualitative information for deficiencies and accreditation as well. So we encourage you to take a look at these different tools. Overall, the Florida Health Finder website is a great resource for consumers. It includes a lot of detailed information on every facility that we regulate. So the Secretary mentioned that we regulate over 40,000 providers. That includes everything from nursing homes, hospitals, to laboratories. And so we have information available at different degrees depending on data that's accessible. The information that we have for the most part about the licensees is updated every night. So if a facility changes ownership or a new facility enters the market or a facility closes, you'll be able to get very current updates on that. We also have regulatory information. So the results of those inspections that we do, if we find deficiencies or if we impose penalties or if we have a clean bill of health, that information is also easily available through our website. We also have the comparative tools that I mentioned, and a good example of the difference in data. So for hospitals, we actually get hospital discharge data every quarter for licensed hospitals in the state, as well as ambulatory surgery centers. And we quantify that information and turn that into the comparative tool that you can find in Florida Health Finder. So you can see different hospitals' volume rates of procedures that they do, how frequently they perform certain procedures. You can see their qualitative information. Much of this information is provided in a comparative way. You can see their rehospitalization rates, infection rates, other very helpful pieces of information about their quality. And we do, again, we show the compliance data here as well as pulling in some national measures that help create benchmarks. From a price comparison perspective, we do have the paid claims data for health insurers, which we'll show you more about today in the Florida Health Price Finder, as well as retail pharmacy prices through our My Florida RX program. This is one of the newer additions to the website. This is hospice quality measures, and this is just a way to show you that we're always looking for new information to add to the website. Some of it is are things that are directed by the legislature. Some are things that we're able to come up with enough information and have a critical mass to be able to share through our routine procedures. So this particular one is about hospice providers, and it provides an information about their licensed beds, their licensed status, their county. It also shows you from some consumer satisfaction surveys, and this is a national survey, how many of their patients or families are willing to recommend the hospice to others.
as well as other HHS quality measures. So this is a nice tool. Each of these items you can click on for additional details to help you understand how the data was collected, what it means, and how it can be used. On this page and any of our quantitative pages or qualitative pages, if you click on the facility name in red on the left, you'll then go to a profile page. And this is available for all the providers that we license in the state. It has a map and also a geographic tool. So if you're not sure where something is or what it's called, you can put in an address and look at facilities within a radius anywhere from 1,000 feet to 50 miles. It has basic information about the location, their addresses, if there are any emergency actions that the agency has taken, such as a prohibition on new admissions or a suspension of the license. That's very easily seen at the top here. You can click on any link to the left and get to information about their inspection reports or the comparative tool. So this is an assisted living facility, and you can see on the left, you can click and go to that comparative tool from here. On the right, you've got contact information, including ownership, number of licensed beds, and license status. And there's a lot more to this below, which I won't go into today. I know we have a tight program, but I encourage you to take a look at this. It's a really wonderful resource. We also publish a lot of consumer guides. So these are helpful to consumers when they're looking for services and gives them an idea of what different provider types offer, what questions to ask, things like that. And just some quick stats on the website. So this is a very popular website for consumers. You can see that we had a big drop in visits in the last calendar year. And that really is, you know, during the pandemic, we really saw a tightening a restriction of people searching for elective types of services. And so we correlate that with some of the drop in numbers here, but you can see historically, this has been a very heavily trafficked website. We do have a tutorial on our YouTube page we encourage you to take a look at, and we also facilitate group webinars. We've done them for the Ombudsman, for Area Agencies on Aging, so if you have a group that you think might be interested, we're happy to facilitate that. And then we do have enhancements that we're working on, so at the end of this month, we expect to publish the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, which will give us additional quality measures for hospital discharge data, looking at admissions, payer type, and updated every quarter. So we, like I said, we're constantly looking to improve this. In terms of our overall transparency efforts, we do have significant stakeholder engagement. We have a quarterly state consumer health information policy advisory council, and that is composed of industry representatives, advocates, and other decision makers. We have several state agencies that are represented. These are public meetings. And a lot of what you see on this website is run through those groups for input and feedback, and they've been a tremendous resource in helping us improve these resources. We also do a lot of outreach. In terms of the legislation, so the first bill we were going to talk about is the Safety and Quality Transparency, House Bill 319 that passed in 2019. And this is basically a bill related to patient safety and quality measures. It requires that hospitals provide transparency to their consumers, both through their website and in person. So this requires hospitals to publish their infection rates, which are on our website already, but this would make it more readily available to consumers. They can link to our website from theirs, but this is something that they're required to make available as well. It also requires that they show their overall consumer assessment of health providers, their HCAHPS scores for patient satisfactory ratings, and their 15-day readmission rates, which are on our website. At this point, we have developed some additional materials. We have a draft that I'll show you in a moment that would actually create a particular document that they would hand to consumers when they walk in. So the rules for this started in October 2019. We had a workshop. We did a proposed rule, and that was published in December. And that was, I'm sorry, December of 2020. So you can tell we've got a little time between November of 19, December 20 of 20, where we were focused on some COVID-related response activities. So, but we're back on track with this. We did, you know, as you're familiar, COVID really took a lot of resources from our agency to support the state. We pulled all the staff we needed to be able to do the outreach and communication with providers and support their important work. But we're back on track with this rule. We had a hearing last week, and we have a form, a draft form that I'm showing you here that we hope to incorporate soon that would pull in these additional items for hospitals to be able to give to consumers when they're scheduling appointments and things like that. So this is pulling information from our website, and the hospitals would be able to actually hand that document to consumers. The next bill we wanted to talk about is the patient safety culture surveys. So this is a bill that passed last year that requires hospitals and ambulatory surgery centers to do a biennial anonymous survey of their employees about the culture of safety in that facility where they work, and that we would publish the results of these findings. So this particular proposal, we had an initial rule development workshop in November. We received comments from that workshop, and we are in hopefully the final stages of developing this language now. A couple of the comments that we got from the workshop that I wanted to share with you is to recognize that a lot of hospitals participate in a national patient safety culture survey. So they do it now every 2 years. So there's been some requests to think about the cycles that they might have already conducted in terms of when we require this. So that we're considering those types of issues, as well as, of course, their engagement in the response to COVID. So we hope to have that finished very quickly, I would say within the next month, and be available for publication. And of course, as we go through the rule process, once we do have a final proposed rule, we make it available for public comment. There may be a hearing requested at that time, but we'll certainly push through that. All right, and then in terms of the development of the data and the display, that we expect to do that through Florida Health Finder. That's our anchor for information. The next bill we wanted to talk about is the price transparency bill. So this bill originally passed in 2016, and this was a pretty significant in scope legislation. It created an all-payer claims database, which was basically the tool to create a price finder application that we'll show you in just a moment. It also required hospitals to give access to consumers of healthcare charge estimates. So we have long posted on Florida Health Finder the prices for healthcare services in hospitals and ambulatory surgery centers, but the prices aren't necessarily what people pay. And so the goal of this initiative was to move beyond the retail price, so to speak, of a healthcare service and show consumers what hospitals are actually charging or being paid for these services. And it's interesting when you start to look at the gap sometimes between those prices. So the process here would also require that consumers have ready access to billing and collection processes at hospitals. So they're required to give consumers more information up front when they receive services, or if they are able to schedule them in advance, so that they have a realistic expectation of what the billing expectations are. The bill also requires insurers to create avenues for a person with health insurance to ask the insurer, what would my copay be? What would my out-of-pocket cost be? And then, of course, it expands what we can do through the Price Finder website, so I'll show you that. Let me start first with the facility and health plan responsibilities. So the facilities have to post online the average payments and payment ranges for bundles of healthcare services. And so bundles of healthcare services, if you think about it from a consumer perspective, if they need a knee replacement, they're probably not going to say, what is the surgery cost? What is the pre-op consultation cost? What is the post-operative therapy cost? They're going to want to know, what is a knee replacement cost? So the website itself looks at services in a bundle. Now, it breaks them down by different payers, and you'll see an example of that. But this concept of bundling services takes it beyond what a hospital might say their costs are and think of it more from the consumer's perspective about what they would actually pay for that service. So the facility does have to provide a written price estimate upon request to consumers for those planned services, and they have to have a process for resolution of patient billing complaints. And that's important. Most providers have had this anyway, but making it more visible to consumers has been very important. I mentioned that health plans are required to have an out-of-pocket cost calculator on their website, so a consumer can say, I need this service. What will my out-of-pocket cost be, which can vary by the type of insurance that they have and the services covered. So the website itself, we did a competitive procurement and actually executed a contract with a vendor, the Healthcare Cost Institute, in March of 2017. And then we launched in November of 2017, the Florida Health Price Finder. Through that website, it's a web-based platform. It's designed in a way that's consumer-friendly, and it was a model that HCCI had in place prior to our procuring it. We could actually look at it before we purchased it and see that they had a functional system at the national level, and this allowed us to customize it more for Florida. So what this system does is it basically takes paid health insurance claims information from payers. So it's collecting data from health plans. It's collecting Medicare and Medicaid data. And it's looking at what those health plans are actually paying a hospital or a physician for the cost of that service. So I mentioned earlier, there can be a big disparity between the retail price for a service and what is actually paid to the provider for that service. So this whole site was designed to get at what's actually paid for those services. It really raised awareness for consumers. We know that a lot of consumers don't see those prices because they're not necessarily paying them out of pocket, but some do. And as different factors come into play, whether it's co-pays or co-insurance, those prices do matter to consumers. And they certainly matter to all of us who help support the cost of the healthcare system. So that was the real goal of this project. So the first final data submission was completed. I'm sorry, the data submission rule, and this is the rule for health plans to submit their data, was completed in November of 2018. And we did the first harvesting of the data where the health plans actually gave the data to the vendor in August of 2019. That allowed us to publish the provider-specific prices for the first time in November of 2019. And we have a separate website, but it's also linked to Florida Health Finder, so you can get to it in multiple ways. And then, so during that first rollout, we onboarded a number of health plans, originally Aetna, Humana, and United. And the onboarding process for these health plans is quite extensive, as you can imagine, when you're looking at getting hundreds of thousands of claims from different payers with different IT systems. You have to match up a lot of data and technology and do a lot of quality checks. And so the onboarding process is quite extensive. We did onboard three additional plans in 2019, and that was AvMed, and then Florida Blue, which also included Capital Health Plan. So those were the three plans in 2019. And then we're working on additional plans to roll out in March or April of 2021. That will be Molina, Health First, which is a big provider over in the Treasure Coast, and CVS, which would be the pharmacy claims for Capital Health Plan. So every year, this is an annual publication that's updated each year. The data harvesting from the health plans is quite an extensive technical process. It does take quite a bit of time, but every year we're able to add more plans, which makes more data available. And this is a picture of one of the bundles. So if you were to go into the website, it often defaults to your geographic area. If it can tell from your browser where you might be dialing in from, this particular one in the top right, you can see Miami-Dade is the geographic region selected. It allows you to look for different procedures or to type in different systems and find what you're looking for. We went ahead and picked one here so that you could look at the bundle for childbirth. So this is a healthcare service bundle for childbirth. And on the right side, you can see that in the bundle, you've got prenatal care, which would be all your visits, your routine lab work, ultrasound, the physician's piece of the delivery charge. Then you've got the actual delivery and newborn care, which is primarily going to be the hospital. And then you've got newborn care, which would be physician's visits after childbirth. So you can see how this breaks it down by different provider groups. The website itself shows facility-specific prices for hospitals and ambulatory surgery centers. And then beyond that, it will show a regional pricing. So instead of listing every physician in a community, it would say, here's generally what those physician services would cost on average in that county, for example. And on the left-hand side of this is actually what you would see before you go to a specific facility. You can actually look at every hospital in the area that has a statistically valid sampling of these claims and see the price array at different hospitals, in this case, for the actual childbirth services. And this is just an example of how the search tool works. So you can browse by condition, body type, you can type in names, you can do alphabetical searches. It's very flexible. And we do also have a tour of the website. So if you go to the main page, you can scroll down and you'll see this at the bottom here, let us start your search. And it'll take you a tutorial through how to use Florida Health Price Finder. At the top here, oops, I think we've actually posted the wrong statistics. I'm sorry. This is a repeat of our Florida Health Finder website, but we can share with you the Florida Health Price Finder statistics as well. They are certainly much lower than Health Finder. Health Finder is a much more comprehensive website with a much broader array of information. Florida Price Finder is a much more narrow, tailored area, but we can update those stats for you. Okay. All right, in terms of transparency compliance, so as you saw, there were several requirements for health facilities in terms of posting their pricing, having a website with this information available. So that is something that we look at every time a hospital or ambulatory surgery center renews their license, which is every 2 years. So we're looking to make sure that their pricing and information is actually viable and works and provides the information that's statutorily required. We also check this during our on-site inspections. So we're looking at the transparency reviews during on-site visits. And of course, if we have any complaints, those are things that we look into from a prompted perspective. Okay. From an enforcement perspective, I just wanted to share the number of citations. They're very small. So we have had complaints. We've had both for ambulatory surgery centers and hospitals. Substantiated means that we found deficiencies when we looked into those complaints. So you can see out of 300 hospitals, they are largely compliant with this requirement, which we are very happy to see. And then on the bottom here, this would be our on-site inspections that result in violations. So anytime we have a violation related to this, the provider is required to correct it in an expeditious fashion. So usually within 30 days, they've corrected these violations and they no longer exist. If they did not correct them, then it would lead to fines and penalties, which has not been the case so far with these. Okay, the transparency bill also requires us to contract with a third party to look at quality indicators or quality projects that we can kind of mine this claims data to see across the hospital setting. And so we have executed a contract with an organization called Comagine. We did that in May of 2020. And basically, they're going to help respond to the statutory requirement to come up with projects on an annual basis to look at, to analyze this data and see if there are trends or helpful qualitative information that can be shared. So the study, one of the things as an example would be preventable hospitalizations using a national formula. So we are already showing preventable hospitalizations from our hospital discharge data, and now we can expand on that. We also are looking at different topics of interest, and those will be provided in terms of our public dashboard so that we can look at regional price variations as an example, quality variations, so we could potentially study the C-section rates and different things like that that might be available from this information. And so it will also give us the ability to do ad hoc reporting so that if we are think that there might be a trend, we could research that. We can look for outlier data to help identify trends in quality. And these are also things that we can certainly share with the providers themselves to encourage quality improvement in other areas of expertise. A couple things we wanted to mention to keep on the radar from price transparency. There's definitely been a lot going on at the federal level. So, you think of Florida, sometimes we're paving the way for some really great ideas that might be adopted nationally. So the work that was done by this legislature a few years ago to make those prices transparent for consumers is now being eyed by the federal government. We've got a federal hospital price transparency rule that became effective January 1st. And in this rule, all hospitals have to publish machine-readable files. And this is probably more if you look at it from the perspective of making data available for others to analyze and package it. So hospitals have to make this machine-readable data available to provide an undiscounted charge master price, so what they actually charge for their services, negotiated rates for networks and contracts, and cash discounted prices as applicable. And they have to do this for the 300 most utilized shoppable services. And shoppable services is important to think about. A lot of the care provided in hospitals is not shoppable. It's things that may happen because someone had an emergency, they go to the emergency room and they end up requiring services. But there are a significant number of services, and so should consider the plan options for their individual patients and what that patient might expect in terms of co-pays and deductibles. And that is expected to be added by January of 2024. Okay, and we also wanted, I think this is the last bill we're going to go over. This is the Certificate of Need Law. So in 2019, there was significant legislation that repealed Certificate of Need for hospitals. So Certificate of Need, this is a competitive process that's been in place nationally since the Nixon administration. And states have implemented different approaches to this and I'd say deregulated it to a large degree in many ways over the many decades, but it was originally designed to create an analysis of whether or not a new healthcare service was needed before there was authorization for a provider to open. So if you can think of, if you have two hospitals in a region, they're serving all the clients in that region, there is not necessarily a need for a new one, those types of considerations would be considered. And if there was not a need for a new hospital, the agency would not publish need and no new hospitals would be built. So that's a very simplified perspective of it, but that's essentially what the program did. So it looked at the need for services, the current providers in the area, and then if there was need in an area, it was a competitive process where applicants would apply. They would say, here's how we think we can meet that need. Here's some special programs we might be able to offer. Here's how we can guarantee our quality, and all of those considerations were evaluated to determine if different providers would be given the authority to open a new hospital or home health agency or nursing home, et cetera. So in 2019, Certificate of Need was repealed for hospitals in a two-phase approach. The first one is immediately in July 1st of 2019, CON was repealed for general acute care hospitals, long-term care, and rural hospitals. And then specialty services within existing hospitals like NICU, neonatal intensive care units, comprehensive medical, transplant, psychiatric, and substance abuse. The phase two will go into effect this July, and that will repeal the certificate of need for new specialty hospitals, which would be rehabilitation, psychiatric, and children's special medical. CON does remain in place in Florida for new hospice providers, nursing homes, and intermediate care facilities for developmental disabilities individuals. So the when the hospital CON was repealed, what we can do at this time is new hospital additions and conversions and new hospital development. Now, keep in mind that even though the certificate of need is gone, we still have significant licensure requirements for new hospitals. They have to meet architectural plan review, prior to construction, they have licensing standards, and then still have to meet federal Medicare and Medicaid requirements. So as we transition from CON to licensure, the bill allowed the CON rules to remain in place until the agency promulgated new licensure rules. So the theory was that some of the requirements for a certificate of need would then be transitioned to licensure. So for example, if you want to create a new neonatal intensive care unit, you have to have a certain volume, either of births or other services. And so there's still a requirement to have some qualitative expectation before you open a new program, but they're transitioning from the CON requirements to the licensure rules. So in July of 2019, right when the bill went into effect, we did post a notification of how we were supplementing the application process to consider those CON requirements that now are, that remain in place until licensure rules are done. So that allowed providers to continue to apply for these programs while the CON rules were being developed. So I wanted to mention a couple of current statistics. So since the CON repeal in 2019, we have had three new comprehensive medical units in existing hospitals. Those have ranged anywhere from 11 to 24 beds. We've had one new neonatal intensive care unit level two in an existing hospital for 10 beds, a new adult kidney transplant designation. And when I presented or put the presentation together, we had one license application for a new hospital, and that actually was licensed today. So we've had our first new hospital after CON repeal. So this would be a hospital that did not have a CON. We still have some hospitals that are coming on that had a CON that were going through the plans and construction process, for example. I wanted to provide that update. In terms of rulemaking, so
Just by way of background, many of these CON rules were open for development prior to the passage of the repeal. So those rules were told or put on hold until the once the legislation was signed, until it went into effect. We have since been working on those rules. We have had hearings and workshops on many of them. Most of the activity occurred prior to COVID, and we did have several hearings and workshops in January and February of 2020. That work was delayed, unfortunately, due to COVID, but we are getting back on track. We actually have recently published a notice of change for the definitions section and the neonatal intensive care unit section. We did have challenges to those rules, but we were able to come to agreement as challenges were withdrawn, and we did have a new hearing last week on those rules, so we hope that those will move in a positive direction. And then we have pending rules. Many of these rules do require that definition section to be completed first, because a lot of the CON language is being addressed in the definition section, so that has broad-reaching implications. The rest of these are pretty close to either a notice of change or a proposed rule. We hope to have a lot of this activity done within the next month, and so just wanted to give you that update as well. All right, the last slide I had is just our resources. Many of the things you've seen today, you can find a lot more information on our website. We also just want to put a plug in for the COVID-19 resources. We have, and the secretary did a great job of talking about our activity. We have provided a tremendous amount of information to our provider community through our website. We host weekly calls, statewide calls with many of these provider types, and continue to funnel great information to them, now mostly about vaccines, but still about cases and new therapies. So we encourage you to take a look at any of these and let us know if you have any questions. All right, well, thank you, Chair. That was the presentation that we had for today.
Ms. McKinstry, thank you so much for the comprehensive presentation. We appreciate not only that, but your time to give it to us today and to be available, and we know that you've been busy at the State Ops State Emergency Operations Center, so thank you. Members, we have a few minutes left here. We have to be wrapped up by 3, but if members have some questions they'd like to ask, then I'll recognize you with the remaining time, and we will try to get some information. Ms. McKinstry, if you can stay with us just a few minutes. I saw Rep Mooney's hand first.
Yes, you're thank recognized you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the information. Great presentation, very detailed. Referencing the hospital report card, there's a lot of detail in that report card, and it seems to be hard that it'd be easy for a patient to understand. I don't know that that's, patients don't need more information, they need better information. Could the agency make this report card more user-friendly?
You're recognized, Ms. McKinstry.
Sure, we will definitely take that back. This is not a final document. We appreciate your feedback on it, and we will definitely see if there's a way to make it, I'm gonna scroll back to it here, to make it more less words and more meaning. So we're happy to take that back and see if we can make some simplification.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sure. And Rep. Fabricio, I think I saw your hand. You'll be followed by Vice Chair Caruso. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McKinstry, thank you so much for your presentation. With regard to patient safety, the patient safety culture surveys, how many other states require hospitals to make the results of the survey available to the public?
You're recognized.
I'm not aware of any other states that are doing this right now. I could be mistaken, but I can certainly check with our team and let you know if there have been any changes in that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow-up?
Sure, yes. Thank you.
I believe the survey must include a question asking if the respondent would seek care at the hospital for themselves or their family. Is that correct?
You're recognized.
Yes.
You're recognized.
I think that's such important piece of information for the public to know. Very few of us have family who work at hospitals, so it's important for us to have that information, and now it is. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Rep. Fabricio. Vice Chair Caruso, and you'll be followed by Representative Tan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Secretary, Deputy Secretary, for your informative presentation. Under HB 1175, you noted that hospitals are required to provide written price estimates. And I'm wondering, in a case where the actual cost exceeded the price estimate, what were the ramifications? How is it reported? Or is it reported?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So there are always the possibility that
procedures might involve an unanticipated cost or consideration or some additional services. That should be part of the estimate. There should be caveats that explain that it is an estimate, that there could be conditions that change it. There is a process where if the consumer does dispute the price, they're able to pursue that with the hospital. We also can look into those cases as well, and we make our complaint line very visible to consumers that have questions. So we're happy to assist on an individual basis to see if there are activities that fall outside of the requirements. But typically, it is an estimate, and it is important that they include in the information to the consumer that, that it is just that. But they should be able to explain any differences because of additional services that might have been needed, et cetera.
I'm fine. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Vice Chair. Representative Tant, you recognize for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Secretary, I have a couple of questions, and I'll keep it short. One is, when we're talking about cost transparency and price transparency in hospitals, how do you figure in the difference between a hospital, say, with a neonatal unit, you know, level one, which is where one of my sons spent 35 days, and a hospital that doesn't? How does a consumer compare the price of those hospitals based, you know, when they're giving birth, when a woman's about to give birth and she chooses a hospital? How is she's likely going to go for the one that's cheaper, even though, you know, there's a whole different level of services there in the other hospital?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So one of the things that's important to think about, it's not just about price, it's certainly about quality and service. So the way that the website is set up, it's based upon the procedures as opposed to the hospital. So typically when you're looking at childbirth, you're probably looking at an uncomplicated delivery. If you were expecting a complicated delivery, you probably would not be able to see a price through Florida Health Price Finder. We do have, for there to be prices shown for a procedure, it needs to be common enough, both by the provider, the hospital, and the payer, to have a statistically valid size sample to display a price. So I think when you're talking about specialized services, if you due to a complicated childbirth, that's probably going to fall outside the scope of what you'd expect to see on these shoppable service prices. However, we do provide a lot of information about different hospitals through our quality information. So you can look on Florida Health Finder and see different information about the facility, which is connected to Florida Price Finder, about infections rates, about the volume of different procedures they perform. If you are going to need a specialized service, if you know in advance, you're certainly going to go to a provider that offers that service. So if you're seeking a hospital for a high-risk pregnancy, there may be providers that you would select based upon their ability to do that. Certainly, if a hospital cannot provide the service, they shouldn't be arranging those services. If you end up in a situation where you expect a normal childbirth and you have complications, that hospital cannot meet your needs. They're required to be able to transfer you in a very expedited fashion to a hospital that can. And so ultimately, getting those services from a provider with that expertise would be achievable for consumers. Does that help?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, thank you. Yeah, the next question goes to CON.
I'm sorry, our time's really limited.
Okay.
And there were a few other members.
Yes, in terms of the CON, I just wanted to make sure, how would I find out that when these rules are being made, that there is quality of care? My son had open heart surgery. We went to Miami Children's. We researched that, but not everybody has that capability. How do I know that somebody who says they have an open heart surgery facility can really deliver the quality of care because they didn't have to go through CON? How do I know for sure that my child's going to be best served? And that will be my last question.
Before Ms. McKinstry, before you answer, without objection, Representative Williamson moves we extend by 10 minutes to 3:10. Without objection, that's approved. So Ms. McKinstry, go ahead and answer, and then we have just a couple other questions that
we'll
wrap
up.
Thank you.
Sure. So I'm going to go to the slide on the rules here. So the rules themselves, there are some programs that we are working on specialized criteria for. So pediatric open heart is one. In addition to the legislation mentioned here, there is legislation that created a pediatric cardiology advisory panel. And so that panel has been meeting for the past 2 years or so to develop recommendations to the agency for rules specifically for pediatric cardiac services. We do believe that we have a final recommendation list from that panel,
And we, at this time, we're pending publication of that rule. That program, you'll find in there, there are significant standards in terms of staffing, in terms of procedure volume that would support the clinical expertise necessary to provide that very specialized services. And so those rules will basically provide the underlying expectations of how programs operate. Yeah, providers that do not operate within that, certainly that's something we can follow from a regulatory perspective, but it is important that we have some basic for a lot of these criteria. Now, the other things to consider are hospitals are typically also enrolled in Medicare and Medicaid, and most of them are accredited by national organizations that are also looking at their quality of care, and we work closely with those accrediting organizations if we have a complaint or concern. Both of us are operating under the purview of the federal government for Medicare and Medicaid, and so I think between both of those resources, if there are issues that are identified, we have the authority to take action and address those. Many times it may result in a corrective action at a facility, but we do have expectations of high quality of care.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. McKinstry. Representative Persons, I saw your hand next. Go ahead with a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McKinstry, thank you for this great presentation. I have a follow-up question regarding written price estimates. You said that facilities must provide written price estimates upon request of the patient. Why shouldn't consumers receive a written estimate every time they come in for a service, and should this not be mandatory?
You're recognized.
Sure, so the legislation did basically make the requirement that it be requested by the consumer. I suspect that there are probably many hospitals that offer this on a routine basis, but I believe that this was a way to get hospitals used to being able to provide these estimates. Now, you can also, consumers can go to the Florida Health Price Finder website and look up hospitals in advance. Of course, that won't be an estimate based on their specific circumstances, but it would give them an idea of the range. And sometimes that's a type of information that's helpful when you're looking at those estimates to see how you fall into that average and get an idea of what different facilities charge.
Thank you. Representative Bisada Cabrera, I think I saw your hand, and then Representative Batana has a quick question as well. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a question about the Health Price Finder. It's a fantastic tool, very user-friendly, but as I was searching on there, it seems that there's a lot of parts throughout the state where we don't have a local cost estimate. Why is that?
You're recognized.
Sure. So the different characteristics that might drive whether or not a price is available, and by the way, we do have, and I can provide to the chair for distribution, a map of the state of Florida to show you how many price bundles are available in each county. So the price bundles are going to be affected by whether or not that county has a sufficient payer mix, and each payer has the minimum market share to be included in that price estimate. I mentioned before you have to have a statistically valid sample size to be able to produce that average number. In addition to whether or not the payer has enough of a payer, the county has enough of a payer mix, the individual payers have to have a minimum number of claims. So if you had a hospital that only did one or two of the procedures in a year, they probably wouldn't have a price for that procedure because they don't have enough to really consider that a statistically valid average. And then each provider has to have a minimum number of claims. So there's a lot of factors that go into the formula to determine if there are enough paid claims to support an actual average price for that procedure in that county and at that provider. Now, as we add health plans, and so that's why I mentioned how many have been added each year, as you add more health plans, you increase that overall population of claims that you're analyzing. So that is going to certainly bring more transparency to different counties. As you have more plans, you have more procedures, more payers, et cetera.
Thank you. Representative Batana, and then our last question will be Ranking Member Joseph. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Chairman Yarbrough. Thank you, Molly, for your presentation. A quick question. How do we educate to get more consumers to use this tool, this Florida Health Price Finder?
You're recognized.
Sure. So we do education now and outreach through for our Florida Health Finder as well as Florida Price Finder. We have the available tutorials before COVID. We did actually a lot of outreach we do have a way to request a webinar through our website. So we actually have a person that will host a webinar. We generally host them on a monthly basis, but we can also do them on an ad hoc basis for our particular group. We certainly encourage the facilities to actually link to them as well. So a lot of the hospitals link to their data on Florida Health Price Finder as their way to show their price transparency. And we will continue to do that type of outreach through whether or not it's the Ombudsman, the Area Agencies on Aging, AARP, and others. Many of those parties actually sit on our Consumer Health Advisory Panel, so AARP is a member of that. So we do look to our partners to help promote it, but we certainly have an avenue to fill in any pockets as they're identified as well.
Thank you. Good. Thank you. Ranking Member, you have the final question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's actually two questions, but they're pretty short. So the first one is the new hospital that was recently licensed after the repealer of the law that we had last time in 2019, where is it located and what's the name? So that's question number one.
You're recognized.
Sure, it's Horizon West in Orlando.
Okay, awesome. And then the second question is, I noticed that you mentioned that CVS was the pharmacy that's associated, and I'm assuming that's an exclusive contract. I was just wondering how long ago that was awarded and selected and how it was selected.
You're recognized.
Sure, so CVS is basically, they're including their pharmacy claims for Capital Health Plan. So what they're, the database is taking paid claims from Capital Health Plan, which is a health plan in town here. And it is part of Florida Blue. So when they became part of the health, the paid claims database, their pharmacy claims were managed separately by CVS. So they were not originally added when Capital Health Plan was included in November of 2019. So it's CVS's Capital Health Plan claims that are being included, not all of CVS. So it's actually not a contract we have that the state has with CVS. Per se, it's through the insurer that's contributing your claims. They actually have a contract with CVS and have added them to the database. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Ranking Member. Members, thank you for engaging in the presentation. It was a lot of information, but thank you for your willingness to engage and ask the questions and participate. Ms. McKinstry, we know you have work to do over there at the Emergency Ops Center. So again, thank you. Thanks for taking the time to be with us today. And we look forward to speaking with you again soon as the issues come up and as we move forward.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And members, just one other note, Erin Osborne, I wanted to mention her. She's one of our great administrative assistants for HHS. She slipped in over there, wanted to mention her and give her a shout out too. We appreciate you, Erin. Thanks for being on the team. Members, this concludes our committee agenda for today. And we have no other items before us. So without objection, Representative Benjamin, moves we rise. So we're adjourned. Thank you. We're adjourned. Thank you very much.